Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Welcome to the sixth podcast seminar on SaifEddin.com. In today's seminar, we have a very special guest, Mr. Pierre Rochard, who is one of my favorite people on Twitter and one of the most important influences on me learning about Bitcoin over the years, both through his account on Twitter as well as his Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, which I highly recommend everybody check out. Pierre and Michael Goldstein currently run the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, and in it they have collected, they've written and collected from others a collection of some excellent essays on Bitcoin and on the importance of Bitcoin. And this is, I would say, maybe the essential requirement reading for becoming a Bitcoiner. And it helped me understand so much about the world and about Bitcoin from reading this. So I highly recommend you go and you check their archive and read the articles about it. And the incredible thing about it is that if you think these writings sound delusionally optimistic at this point, I'd like you to imagine just how delusionally optimistic they must have sounded back in 2013, when Bitcoin was about 1/1000th of the size of where it is right now.
So it's quite astonishing when you see them discussing Bitcoin's monetary policy with in comparison with the Fed's monetary policy in one of Pierre's most influential blog posts, which is "End the Fed Hoard Bitcoins." And it's really outstanding to think that in 2012 and 2013, somebody was thinking in these terms, because at that point, Bitcoin was really toy money. And to see that, well, this thing has a monetary policy that's better than the monetary policy of the Fed, and so clearly it's going to overtake it. I mean, you know, my book, I try and make this case through 300 pages. And I think, you know, it becomes more and more likely the more you think about Bitcoin. And now we see in 2020, we see a lot of people who, you know, arrive at this conclusion, like Michael Saylor, our guest last week. You know, he had no interest in this stuff ideologically until he started thinking about monetary policy for the sake of his business, and came across this conclusion that, no, that Bitcoin is better than the dollar, and I'm going to put my cash balances in Bitcoin. And but, you know, Pierre could see this back in 2012 and 2013, and he wrote some of the most important ideas, I think, in shaping the discussion and the people's and the understanding that people have of Bitcoin by comparing the monetary policy. It was the first time that I saw the graph of Bitcoin's supply graphed out, you know, the 21 million and the growth rate in his blog post. He's always had a penchant for running the numbers, and it's a great habit. You should always run the numbers, because once you just start running the numbers, you'll never know what you'll find once you run the numbers. It's always a good idea. Some of the best ideas in the world come from running numbers. So, Pierre, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the fixed supply, and that, like, I saw this in 2012. I remember before I heard about Bitcoin at all, and so this was probably maybe even before Bitcoin was publicly released, because I started learning about sound money in like 2005. I had this thought that if you could have a money that had a fixed supply, that would be better than gold. Because I already knew that, like, okay, gold gets extracted, you know, by a certain percentage, got that stock to flow ratio. But I already knew that itself had a distortionary effect. And so, for example, when the New World was discovered and they discovered all this new gold, I already knew that there was like that Cantillon effect, the redistributive effect of new gold supply coming into circulation. And so already I had it in mind that the ideal would be 100% reserve banking with a fixed supply asset. It never crossed my mind that that would be a realistic thing, because I didn't know about cryptography. I didn't know about proof of work or anything like this, obviously. So, yeah, it goes back quite a ways.
Yeah, I agree. I remember, you know, reading Austrian economics, but I started later than you in 2008 and 9. Reading those, you come to the conclusion that, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could find a way to fix the money supply? And I just remember, you know, thinking there's just no way of doing that, because any incentive structure that you would have into place for people to agree to try and stop making more of one thing, there's always going to be an incentive to defect from that. And there's always going to be a way for people to break it. And the history of the gold standard shows that, you know, we couldn't even stick to gold, and even and gold is not even 100% capped. But Bitcoin is just is amazing in this regard. And the fact that Bitcoin supply is fixed and completely verifiable is an absolutely astonishing idea, which is a drum that you have been very excellently banging over the last couple of months, and really rubbing the point in to everybody's head that we've never had anything like this where we can just verify the total supply. So can you tell us more about what the implications of that are?
Yeah, so that was a huge blind spot for me. Even though I thought a fixed supply would be great, it never crossed my mind that verification of that supply, you know, would kind of be the only way you would enforce it. And that, you know, even when I was studying gold, I didn't really strongly make the connection between the fact that in the market for money with gold, you have mints because it is too expensive to assay gold as it circulates as money. And so you ultimately have to trust a third party, the mint, and that makes gold vulnerable to then having the mint be nationalized or taken over by a sovereign and then corrupted, right, as they dilute the coinage. And that goes back to ancient Rome. So that vulnerability of gold wasn't something that I had internalized even after reading Mises and Rothbard and Holzman. Like, they talk about it, but it didn't register of abstracting away to, okay, so if everyone was able to be your own mint, right, and to verify the coins that you're receiving in kind of a trust minimized manner, that's what actually would allow you to then enforce the monetary policy. So that verifiability takes several forms. One is what I would call kind of the local verifiability. So when somebody is sending you Bitcoin and they're telling you, okay, we have this outstanding liability, I'm going to pay it off, right? And this applies whether you're standing at McDonald's, you know, paying for your burger, or if you are a Boeing, you know, selling $1 billion worth of airplanes. And so you want to make sure that the person who owes you the money is actually sending you the money that they're telling you that they're sending before you extinguish the debt and say, okay, we're settled. And so in the current system, you kind of have to rely on the bank telling you that the settlement has happened, or that, well, in the case of George Floyd, that the $20 bill that he handed was a real $20 bill. And so there, you know, in the case of George Floyd, they had to call the police because they weren't sure if the $20 bill was real or not, right? So it's kind of a crazy verification system that you have to call someone who's got a gun to come over and to take a look at your $20 bill. That doesn't scale at all, clearly, because, you know, we saw what the result of that was. It was horrific. So then you have the global verification of, it's not so much that I care about did I actually receive Bitcoin or not, it's what percentage of the total Bitcoin supply did I receive, right? What assurances do I have that I'm not getting diluted and that somebody else is spending my Bitcoin in a way, right? That's kind of the double spending issue of dilution, or that somebody else is creating Bitcoin outside of what my expectations are with what the total supply of Bitcoin ought to be. So if a miner, for example, were to give themselves more Bitcoin than they ought to have, right, what is the current halving? You know, right now it's 6.25 Bitcoin. If they give themselves 7 Bitcoin and they're sending it to someone else, it doesn't directly affect me, right? And there's not really, you could make the argument that I should not care. But I do care because I'm also receiving Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin. So I also want to make sure that the global rules of the system are being respected. And in the current iteration of money, you have to do that by electing the right president who is going to appoint the right Federal Reserve chairperson who is going to release "quote unquote" audited financial statements, right? We know that there's Ron Paul has been beating the drum of audit the Fed far longer than I've been beating the drum. Ron Paul has wanted to run the numbers far longer than I've been saying that we should run the numbers. But at the end of the day, Ron Paul has to depend on a political process by which to run the numbers. The promise of Bitcoin is that you don't have to lobby someone to run the numbers. You can just do it yourself. You download the software, you sync it up, and you can verify Bitcoin supply, which is impossible to do with U.S. dollars because even the Federal Reserve doesn't do it, right? Here's another example. The Federal Reserve as part of the war on terrorism, right, of invading Iraq, which, okay. And they wanted to send billions of dollars to Iraq. And so what did they do? They printed $100 bills. They put it on pallets. They put it inside of C-130 transport aircrafts. They flew it across the Atlantic. They landed it in, you know, Bagram Air Base, whatever, in Iraq. And then it disappeared. Okay. So we don't even really know, okay, did it get destroyed or who has it at this point? Billions of dollars of physical cash, right?
You might have it in your pocket today.
Yeah. How do you think I bought this house? yeah. So there's all sorts of ways in which the fiat system is unverifiable. And then with gold, okay, we have actually better verifiability with gold in some ways, but actually I would argue that if you take a $100 bill, one of the reasons the US dollar was able to replace gold as the global reserve currency is that they were able to improve the verification technology of $100 bills. And so the cost of counterfeiting $100 bills became high enough that now we can actually use $100 bills as a final settlement cash system that arguably is less expensive than assaying gold. Now, we can get into debates about that versus whether, you know, legal tender laws and you know, the threat of violence is actually more influential for market participants. But I think that if $100 bills were trivially counterfeitable, then the U.S. dollar would have collapsed a long time ago, right? It wouldn't be a debate there. But yeah. They have, you know, made the technology such that they can do some verification of $100 bills. So I'll leave it there and move on to the next question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's an absolutely fascinating concept when you think about it, in that what really matters in money is not how many units you have. You know, you don't care if you have 1 or 10 or 100. You care about how much actual real stuff they buy you. That's why if I gave you the choice between having 1 US dollar or 10 Japanese yen, you prefer to have $1 over 10 yen, even though 10 is a larger number than 1. And understandably, our Keynesian listeners might be confused by this concept. They think that, you know, 10 is better than 1. So obviously take the 10 yens. That gives you more GDP, more numbers. But some of us, you know, we realize I'd rather take the $1 because it buys me more stuff, more apples and oranges and cars and homes. And with $1 can be purchased than 10 yen. So the number doesn't matter. What you really care about is the purchasing power. And that's the point that Rothbard and Mises and the Austrians always stress about money, that money is not a good that you buy for its own sake. You don't care about accumulating a number of goods, a number of units of it. What you care about is the purchasing power. And the purchasing power is dependent not just on how many you have, but on how many are out there. And we've never had a form of money where we can count everything that's out there. We have estimates about how much gold there is, but we don't really know for sure because, you know, who knows? Anybody can mine gold and keep it hidden. They don't have to clear it with some kind of decentralized network for verification that verifies that this is legit gold and that it exists in your vault. So you never really know how much gold is being made. And of course, I think I think gold bugs and hard money people underestimate just how much of a problem tungsten and fake gold really is. Like, you can go on Alibaba.com today and buy fake tungsten gold bars, 1 ounce, and coins. You can buy 1 ounce coins and bars, and they'll cost a fraction of what they should cost in gold. And they're gold coated, but in the middle they're tungsten. So they're much cheaper than just buying the actual gold. But it's very hard for, you can't really tell with the naked eye, and you can't tell with any superficial testing. You need a pretty sophisticated $5,000 spectrometer in order to be able to verify whether this coin is correct. And so I think every year a new supply of gold is being produced from all of this fake gold. And every year also a whole supply, a whole part of the gold supply is getting decommissioned because people are eventually running across a fake coin and it's no longer being used or it's getting melted down and so on. So the gold supply is becoming a lot more industrial because there's just a lot of fake gold entering the supply. Bitcoin fixes this.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, absolutely. So to me, the purchasing power part is directly related to what percentage of the supply you own. And if you talk with like sophisticated institutional investors, right, they when they're buying stocks, they don't look at the price of the stock, right?
Absolutely.
Because that's arbitrary. Berkshire Hathaway has like $100,000 stock. That doesn't make it better than Apple shares that are trading at $100. What you want to look at is what percentage of the equity am I buying? This became really astounding to me when there was an Ethereum influencer called Eric Wall, I think. He was making the argument that Ethereum people are more sophisticated than Bitcoin people, that they understand things better than Bitcoin people. And our friend Michael Goldstein, the memester, asked him a simple question of, okay, well, do they know how to verify the total supply of Ethereum?
And articulate it.
Yeah. How do they calculate it? How do they just sum it up, And it's kind of a simple question from a software engineering perspective, or it ought to be. Astoundingly, there was no real response to it, because the bottom line is that when Michael Goldstein asked that question, there was no open source code to actually sum up the total supply of ETH. It only existed inside of proprietary data platforms that had they had artisanally created this code themselves. And so obviously across data vendors, there was no agreement on what the actual supply of Ethereum was. That's when I was thinking about, okay, Bitcoin had a near miss, not near miss. There was an unexploited bug, a year or 2 years ago now, a possible inflation vulnerability. And at the time, it did freak me out, because to me, this was like the core value proposition of Bitcoin. If someone were able to exploit a bug in the Bitcoin software that allowed them to create more Bitcoin, that would be catastrophic. And I was assured by the developers that, no such thing had happened and it wasn't a problem. And I kind of took that at face value, right? And one should not do that. One should not trust anyone. Got to verify. And so this came back up when Michael Goldstein was asking about Ethereum, because eventually the Ethereum people, they came up with a script, right? They wrote one. Okay, they were able to run it once, but they could not run it at every point in time in the past, right? So ideally what you want, and this is from my, so my background is accounting. So I got my bachelor and master in accounting. I worked at Deloitte. I'm intellectually interested in auditing, but in practice I found it to, be tedious, because a lot of the accounting and audit world, they're still living in 1950, you know, they're running the numbers by hand, which to me is insanity when we have computers. And so that's why I got into software development, because I wanted to automate running the numbers, because I know that computers are better at running the numbers than humans are, much better. And that there's a Jevons paradox, that the less expensive we make it to run the numbers, the more we can run the numbers, which is fantastic. The more efficient we are with auditing, the more auditing we can do, and thus the more reliable we can have of financial statements. Okay, so when I look at, all right, how would we audit the supply of an asset, right? The first thing you want to look at is the issuance. How does the asset come into existence? So for example, within a company, the way the cash comes into existence is that someone makes a capital contribution. So the owner of the business will deposit cash in his business, right? And so then you'll debit cash and you'll credit equity. And the debits and credits equal out, right? And so, okay, how do you apply that to a decentralized cash system like Bitcoin? So the cash comes into existence through the mining process, right? That's how Bitcoin get issued. And so, okay, how does that work? Well, every block, it's 50 Bitcoin at the beginning. And then at specific block heights, we have Bitcoin halvings. And so I kind of got into how do these halvings get calculated, right? From a software development perspective. It's actually more complex than I thought. It involves this operation of bit shifting. And so if you ever hear me tweet about right shift, I'm not making a political statement. I'm talking about the actual operation that your Bitcoin node does when it's calculating how much is the miner entitled to. And so every halving is an additional right shift. And what that right shift means is that if you turn the number 50 into, well, so first of all, multiply it by 100 million, because we're always talking about Satoshis when we're looking at the code. Here's why we do that, right? Because humans can reason about decimal numbers. Computers are actually have a very hard time reasoning about decimal numbers. There's not really any, so when you do what's called floating point, which is, non-round numbers, 0.01, for example, is a floating point number. Computers can't run the numbers on that. They'll have little residual errors in it because they're not programmed to deal with sub-integer numbers. And I won't get into the computer science of it. It's impossible. All they do is zeros and ones. You can't do a 0.5. maybe we can talk about quantum computing and stuff. But in any case, Vitalik's not here, right? When we're looking at zeros and ones, you have to use integers. And so that's why we always have to talk about Satoshis when we're looking at the Bitcoin code itself. We can't talk about Bitcoins. Those are a human construct that we do for pretty UIs in order to reason about this.
We won't have to do them for long, I think.
Yeah. One day, one Satoshi will have the same purchasing power that $1 has today. And so that'll make things really convenient. Does anything cost less than $1 anymore? I feel like before you could buy a soda for 5 nickels or for 1 nickel, but now that's impossible.
It seems, also with the cash shortage, everything is going to be $1.
That's the minimum unit of account. In any case, we do this right shift operation on 50 Bitcoin times 100 million. And when you do a right shift, I won't get into why this happens with the zeros and ones, but you cut the number in half, right? So you do the right shift once, you cut it down into 25 Bitcoin. You do it again, you cut it half again into 12 and a half Bitcoin. You do it a third time, which we started doing in May of this year, right? This is very new that we do the right shift three times. You get down to 6.25 Bitcoin. And you can actually project that out into the future. And you can also recalculate it yourself in the past, right? So I don't have to depend on the C++ code that does this right shift. I can program it myself in Python or in JavaScript or in any other programming language. And I should come to the same result as the C++ code that everyone's relying on, or most people are relying on with their Bitcoin node. So I did that. And this is what auditors do. So if someone comes to you and says, well, here's theoretically how the issuance ought to be, right? And they might come to you with a legal contract that says, here's what we signed. And that's kind of the, you know, I hate using this word, the social contract of Bitcoin, of, you know, we're going to have these halvings every 210,000 blocks.
Yep.
That we have a halving. Why do I know these numbers? Because I spend way too much time on this stuff. And no one should have this memorized. But anyway, so every 210,000 blocks, you have this halving. That's kind of the social contract. And then we want to run the function, in my case, in Python, where I was able to show, okay, you can give me any block height. I'll tell you exactly what the total Bitcoin issuance ought to be. Okay, so that would be simple. Then it starts getting very nuanced. First of all, you know, we were talking about a fixed supply of 21 million Bitcoin. If you actually run the numbers on the issuance alone, right, we haven't even gotten to beyond just the theoretical issuance, you come short of 21 million Bitcoin, because the last halving happens before you've issued a full 21 million Bitcoin. And yeah. When people say 21 million Bitcoin, they're kind of rounding up at the end. There's about 2 million Satoshis, which is a tiny fraction of a Bitcoin, right? It's 2/100ths, so it's like 2% of Bitcoin that ultimately we're missing, just based on the way that the halving function is implemented with the right shifting halving. So, you know, we've had three halvings. There are 29 halvings to come. And the last halving, hypothetically, will be in the year 2100 something. That's one thing, is that we're not ultimately going to be able to issue the total 21 million Bitcoin. Now, the other nuance is that miners can issue up to that amount, but they can also issue less than that, right? Because who cares? If a miner wants to shoot themselves in the foot and not give themselves money, why should we stop them?
You can't stop them. It's a permissionless system.
And people have theorized about how could we verify that they are not underpaying themselves. And that actually is rather complex. So do we want to add complexity to the system of verifying that they are not, you know, creating a deflation bug? It's hard to do. So why do it? You know, let them figure it out. And if it's in their self-interest to claim the full amount. If they don't want to claim the full amount, that's a free giveaway to the rest of us, which is, you know, that's fine. And really, I like this mental or this approach of, you know, it's every man for themselves, or every woman or zer or whatever for themselves, because we can't force you to not destroy Bitcoin. And this happens with miners, but it also happens with people who are creating transactions in Bitcoin. You can create a transaction in Bitcoin that is unspendable. So in the sense that after you send this transaction, you could destroy the Bitcoin. Right? Nobody is going to prevent you from destroying Bitcoin. And you can also destroy Bitcoin by destroying your private keys. Yeah. That's happened as well. Okay, so let's rewind. So the miners can issue less Bitcoin than they want to themselves. So that already, from an audit perspective, okay, what we want to do is we want to look at every instance of a miner creating Bitcoin. And if they create less Bitcoin than they were supposed to, then we're going to add that to our reconciliation, right? Because we're trying to trace, all right, what is the difference between the total amount of Bitcoin in existence today versus the social contract, right? Versus the issuance function that we were expecting in an ideal world. So we take into account miners destroying the Bitcoin. Now, we also have to take into account situations where the output, right? So every Bitcoin is locked up in an output. And what this output is, it's a combination of some amount of Bitcoin and a script, or as the marketing people would say, a smart contract that says, okay, in order to spend these Bitcoin, you have to come to the system, you have to have an input that is going to unlock this output. And typically what that will be is that'll be a signature from the private key that is associated with the output's address. All right, so that's a mouthful. But basically, when you receive the Bitcoin, the reason you received Bitcoin is that you provided an address to someone else, and they locked up Bitcoin to that address. And so if you want to unlock the Bitcoin from that address, you have to prove that that's your address, that you generated that address using this private key. And so that's what the signature is all about. Now, there's more complex ways of doing it, right? We can get into multi-sig, to other ways where you've got to combine several things. But in any case, you also have outputs that are completely unspendable, because when the person created the transaction, they either did something wrong or they did it deliberately. So you have people doing op return. What is op return? It's when they want to put data into the blockchain, okay? So we're very intolerant of this, because it uses up resources for really purposes other than having a cash system, right? We want a peer-to-peer cash system. We're not here to stuff all of your data into the blockchain. So
there's shitcoins for that.
Yeah, exactly. Or SQL databases. Or yeah,
exactly, databases. You know, that works much better.
Yeah. And so the Bitcoin developers, when they're looking at, okay, well, we're trying to create a scalable system here. So if you're just stuffing the blockchain with data, with your op returns, we're not even going to include that output in what's called the unspent transactions, the unspent transaction output set, the UTXO set. So you might hear this abbreviation, UTXO set. And what that set is, in every Bitcoin node, it's keeping this entire set in memory, if you've got enough memory, because it's big. It's like 3 gigabytes right now, or on disk. And so every time that that you get a new block received by your node, and you're trying to verify everything, right, to make sure that no new Bitcoin are getting created, you're not getting scammed, you're able to take this block and apply it to the UTXO set, because that's going to allow you to update the UTXO set to, okay, what's the current state of the system? You can kind of think of the UTXO set as Bitcoin's ledger, as the ledger balances, while the transactions are updates to the ledger balance, right? They are ledger entries that you're going to want to sum up at the end of the day to see what your ledger balance is. And so these useless pieces of data, the op returns, they get removed from the UTXO set because they are unspendable. They'll never be able to be spent. And so rather than spamming the UTXO set with data that is completely useless, we want a purity test, right? We want to gatekeep the UTXO set. Otherwise, people will be able to spam the UTXO set until it takes up so much data that your node will crash, your computer will run out of memory, and the when blocks come in, it's very computationally intensive to compare the UTXO set with the block that your node is receiving. And so if the UTXO set is too big, then that's a huge computational drawdown on your node, and that's terrible for Bitcoin scaling. So ultimately, we want to reject unspendable outputs. Now, from the auditor's perspective, that's a problem, because now your ledger is basically saying, okay, for the op returns have some, they usually put some dust amount of satoshis, because you have to have some amount of satoshis associated with the output, even if it's unspendable. And so these people are destroying Bitcoin in order to spam the blockchain with their stupid data. And so that's where we want to be able to, even if they have satoshis associated with it, exclude them from the ledger. Now, the auditor wants to take them into account, right? Because they are part of the reconciliation process. So we've had several reconciliation items that are going to help us get to the 21 million Bitcoin, right? So the miners giving themselves less Bitcoin than they should, and then these unspendable outputs. There are other edge cases, right? And I won't get into them, where it's kind of like bugs that we take into account. The bottom line, the TLDR, is that all of these little nuances in Bitcoin, we can account for them to the last Satoshi, down to the last Satoshi. There's no rounding errors, okay?
Yeah.
You add it all up, and it equals exactly what you expect it to. And this was actually not possible at every block height before I ran the numbers, before I did a reconciliation for Bitcoin. And it's interesting, because I was criticizing Ethereum for not being able to do this, and then I realized, hey, actually, we can't even do this on Bitcoin today. Now, the nice thing about Bitcoin is that I immediately got a message from someone on Twitter saying, hey, this person is actually already working on this. They were working on it before you started making loud noises about it on Twitter. And so there was already a pull request on Bitcoin that creates an index where at every block height, we're able to sum up the UTXO set and all of these little differences. And so I worked with that developer to create kind of a, what to me is a very rigorous audit of Bitcoin supply. And frankly, I was trying to think of ways that I could improve it. It's very solid. I don't really, and the other thing is that it didn't find any differences. And so that's where, from an auditor's perspective, you kind of, every time you find a difference that's not reconciled, you want to pull on that thread, right? You want to dig into it, because that means there's something that's not adding up in the ledger, and you need to identify it. Now, in Ethereum, there's red flags all over the place, right? There's threads that we could pull on left and right. And they're trying to do what I did with Bitcoin. I know they're trying to do this because they're in my DMs talking about it. There's a number of different issues. The main problem they have is the huge amount of data involved, because they have allowed their blockchain to be spammed with CryptoKitty, broken Tamagotchi emulators. And so they're having to process terabytes of data. I complain about gigabytes. They have terabytes of data. So you need to have a supercomputer to be able to, so every time they tweak their reconciliation and they have to rerun all of this analysis, it takes them a week. And so it's like, how are you supposed to be able to, and they have excellent hardware, right? They have servers with SSDs, 16 processors, gigabytes of, far more gigabytes of data than I, or of RAM than I have. Like, my laptop has 32 gigabytes of RAM. I think that's a lot, right? And yeah. And the only reason I spent money on RAM instead of Satoshis is because I use my computer all day long. But hey, I don't have to justify how I spend my money, okay? It's permissionless.
I mean, We hang you by your own petard, as they say. We host you by your own petard. You're sitting on a chair, Pierre. And we're going to get to that, I guess.
I thought this was a private conversation. If you guys tweet this out, I'm going to be really upset. I got lots of chairs in the background. So it's very expensive for Ethereum. And that's kind of that's the end result of their scaling approach, right? And that's why I really think there was a huge amount of wisdom in 2017 when a lot of the Bitcoiners, were very intolerant with increasing the block size limit to 2 megabytes, because it's a slippery slope. And we don't want running a node and being able to add up Bitcoin's, monetary policy to turn into the Federal Reserve or gold or Ethereum. Like, we want to be able to do it on a Raspberry Pi, ideally, you know? And, okay, I argue that's how we can be inclusive, right? That's how we can have the most diversity in Bitcoin, is to make it as inexpensive as possible to run a Bitcoin node so that it's accessible to anyone in the world. And that's kind of my view of the Bitcoin philosophy.
I agree with you entirely. And I think this is why the shitcoins don't compare, because ultimately there's no possibility with Ethereum of people being able to independently run their own node and verify the supply in mass like we see it with Bitcoin. You know, we see Bitcoin random Anon accounts posting screenshots of them running the numbers on their node at home, and they're all, you know, gloating and matching how all of their nodes show the exact same number of Satoshis out there. And it's, the ability to be able to do this on a few $100 of hardware is an enormous, maybe not just an enormous part of Bitcoin's value proposition. It's like the bedrock of Bitcoin's value proposition, because without this, you don't know how much your Bitcoins are as a percentage of the total supply. So you don't really know what they're worth. And of course, it means that the monetary policy then can never be verified. So we think we have 21 million, but we'll never be able to know unless we can run nodes and unless we can have thousands of people running the nodes all over the world at the same time.
Yeah, because if we made it so that you have to have a data center in order to run a node, that's exactly the situation we were in with mints and gold. And so then the government can come in and nationalize these data centers. And then the IMF will say, hey, all the Bitcoin nodes, we're upgrading the software.
We're adding Keynesian inflation to make it work better.
These Bitcoin are not circulating fast enough. So we're going to change the rules up a little bit.
And if it's 10 data centers, you can do that.
Absolutely. And then we get into arguments of, well, hold on, that's kind of just a slippery slope fallacy. I disagree. I think it's only a matter of time, right? Because I can project out, okay, 1 megabyte every 10 minutes. How much data is that going to take up? You know, how long do we want our monetary system to be decentralized for? If we want it to be decentralized for the next 1,000 years, right, then we got to think long term. If we want to change our monetary system every 5 years, okay, that's what Ethereum wants to do, right? Like every five years, we're going to have
2.0.
Yeah, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. It's going to get harder and harder to. Let's talk about that. With Ethereum 2.0, Vitalik will tell you, he says it black and white, it will get even harder to verify the ETH supply, if we can even call ETH 2.0 ETH, because I'd argue that it's going to be like, it's like Bcash, right? Like our BCH, BTC. No, they're not. I think that maybe they'll split out into, hey, do you want some ETH or do you want some ETH upgraded, right?
Yeah, well, they've already got ETH Classic, so they're just cannibalizing their own little mindshare. And of course, that's... I think I lost what I was going to say. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's going to, and that's the thing too, is that, okay, if I can't verify Ethereum 1.0, then how do you know that when they launch Ethereum 2.0 and they say that they moved all the Ethereum to Ethereum 2.0, but there's not really any way of even knowing what was going on 1.0. I just, I, I would not want to hold
screenshots. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. The screenshot from CoinMarketCap or these websites will still remain affordable for people like Vitalik to be able to use them. So I think as long as you have that, then you've got, you know, enough verifiability. But ultimately, this is, you know, the people at Ethereum don't have to contend with these questions, I think, because it's never going to really matter. Like, they don't have the infrastructure for it to become important to the matter. They can always continue as just a scam that's running in the side for all the people who want to come into Bitcoin and diversify and come with the mentality of the stocks where you need to diversify. And they think this is, you know, this is a market rather than a protocol. So there will always be demand for that, but they don't have to do anything serious, because if they did, you know, there are already an enormous amount of problems with the decisions that they're doing on a technical level. But let's not waste time on inconsequential shitcoins and get to Austrian economics. I want to talk about your development and funding. Before we get to that, your funding of Bitcoin development, before I get to that, there's an idea that's been really nagging in my brain for the last few weeks, which is that if you read Praxeology and read Mises and Human Action, Mises repeatedly says the problem with economics, the problem with making predictions in economics is that economics has no constants. Economics deals with human actions, and human action contains no constants. There are no constants in human action. And I think that's a very profound point. When, you know, he compares it to physics, for instance, or you can think about it as a difference with physics. There are constants in physics that we know, that we measure, that we can verify. Everybody knows what a meter is, and everybody knows what a kilogram is, and then we know what a second is, and then kilogram, meter, and second, you put all of those together, and then you can get equations for force and power and energy and so on. So you can run equations, you can make predictions, you can know that this engine will run on this amount of fuel for this many hours and produce this much power, and you can put all of these in units because you can make units because you can have constants. In economics, you don't have that, except now that I think about it, you know, with Bitcoin, we are kind of developing something like that. We do have a constant, because unlike gold, because gold always increases, so gold was the closest thing that we had to a constant in economics. But still, the gold supply was increasing every year at a couple of percent. And, you know, sometimes you find North America, and then that brings an enormous amount of North American gold. And
asteroid.
Or an asteroid or something like that. So you never really know what's going on. So you can't really measure things against the constant of gold, because gold itself is not constant. But now with Bitcoin, we have a constant. And this is absolutely mind-blowing, because maybe this is going to change how we do economics, because we can always measure everything against this one constant. You'll always have prices measured against Satoshis. And so, you know, in 100 years from now, we're going to have the price of apples and cars and homes expressed in Satoshis over 100 years. And I think that's, you know, maybe that's going to turn economics into more of a quantitative field. Have you thought about this?
Yeah, so I think that one of the methodological challenges in when we're looking at Bitcoin is that, you know, that issuance function that I was describing was written by a human, I'm assuming, right? I don't want to assume Satoshi's species, but I think he was a human. That as Austrians, like, so anything man-made to us is well within the province of praxeology, rather than being in the world of physics. But that's kind of only at a first approximation, because if we look at, for example, even gold, right? Like, gold has actual chemical properties that exist outside of human action, right? It's outside of our human control what gold's chemical properties are. And then with Bitcoin, I would argue that Bitcoin is, its supply function is at this point outside of human control, in the sense of no single individual can change it, right? And so we could theorize about, oh, what if this social consensus were to suddenly change, right? Because we all cooperate and we, the spontaneous order shifts the shelling point away from Bitcoin's fixed 21 million supply. I think that is just as fantastical of a notion as saying, what if all of the atoms were to align such that I fall through my chair? In theory, it's entirely possible. You know, if you look at physics and chemistry, it's statistically, there is some small little possibility that I fall through my chair right this instant because all of the atoms align perfectly, right? It's never happened before, right? Of course. But we can always posit, and this is something that Nick Szabo writes about with Pascal scams, where we could come up with very low probability, high impact outcomes, right? And if you do the expected value calculation and hand wave, you can say, well, this is what I should worry about, right? And so, okay, theoretically, an asteroid could hit Earth, and thus all human action should be directed towards building spaceships that shoot down asteroids, right? Just like in the movie Armageddon, great movie. I'm going to rewatch it tonight. And so that's a Pascal scam because you could come up with, oh, well, global warming. Global warming is going to cause the Earth to flood. And then we won't have land anymore.
And thus, so stop everything.
Yeah, stop what you're doing.
Or a virus. A virus is going to hit and now suddenly everybody in the planet has to stay home. Just imagine how ridiculous that would be.
So humans are very vulnerable to Pascal scams.
It's the precautionary scam as well. You know, as long as you make something scary enough, then you can't be critically thinking about how realistic this scenario is. You can't assess the evidence. You just have to, you know, once I bring in a scenario where it's doomsday, then it's like a trump card where everybody needs to drop everything that they're doing and, you know, take into account that this is happening. But that's not how the world works.
If we're dishonest about Bitcoin, then we could just market it as a Pascal scam, right? And you know, you can find Satoshi writing this of like, well, if it works out, you're going to be incredibly rich, right? So even if there's just a 0.1% chance that Bitcoin works, you should still buy some. And so, you know, we can use that in our marketing, but that's not really the strongest argument for Bitcoin, obviously, right? There's non-Pascal scam arguments for Bitcoin, just as there are for a lot of different things with a low probability, high impact outcome. And so we can't just take that out of context. And so that's where I think that when people say, oh, you know, what if Bitcoin does need to change its supply function in the future, right? And thus Bitcoin's supply is not fixed. It's a social compact, just like the U.S. Constitution. And we know what happened to the U.S. Constitution, right? It gets violated left and right. And so it's not a binding agreement. My counter argument to that is that I can run the Supreme Court on my Raspberry Pi. Okay, there's a Supreme Court on my Raspberry Pi. I get to appoint all nine justices. If I want to appoint all nine justices to say, you know, I can run nine nodes in my house. And they can be each running their own software, but if they all have that same halving function, right, with the right shift every 210,000 blocks, they're all going to come to the exact same verdict, the exact same ruling. And so that's where the metaphor falls apart of Bitcoin is not a social contract like a constitution where we have to have trusted third parties that are going to adjudicate disputes about this system, right? It's not that at all. It's a cryptographic system where you are your own central bank. You are your own Supreme Court. You are the only person who can say, hey, you said you sent me a Bitcoin transaction. It's not here on my node. Where's my money? You still owe me money. What are you talking about? You sent me Bitcoin. Prove it to me, right? And so that's where I think that we can come to a very different analysis. Let's bring it back to the praxeology, right? Where I think that if someone thinks they can change Bitcoin's 21 million Bitcoin rule, they're just a crazy person, right? Like I don't need to listen to their opinion on things. And And so to me, Bitcoin supply actually kind of falls outside of praxeology. It falls more within the domain of, frankly, computer science, right? Does right shifting bits work? It does. The science is clear on this, right?
Yeah.
Talk to any computer scientists. They'll tell you, they'll look at the code. They could formally verify it. I don't think anyone's, oh, you know what? We've made a discovery here. I was saying, hey, how could we get an even better audit of Bitcoin supply? Let's have some computer scientists formally verify right shifting zeros and ones. It's doable because I've heard that it would be very hard to formally verify the entire Bitcoin system, but I think that we could absolutely formally verify the issuance function itself and come up with the same integer values, right? But anyway.
Yeah, that sounds like a kind of project for your latest Bitcoin project, which we wanted to talk about. Pierre started a new bounty program for financing Bitcoin development. So if there's anything that you'd like to see on Bitcoin, or if there are people working on something that you like to see happen on Bitcoin, you can now pay them to work more on it, thanks to Pierre's new introduction, which he wants to tell us about. But before, I'm wondering, you know, this is a problem that you had with Bitcoin, and, you know, you could have just done the normal thing that normal people do, which is complain and moan about it and harangue others and demand that they do things and attract attention to yourself and, you know, maybe launch a whole podcast where you get to point fingers at everybody for not doing enough. But instead, you chose to go and do something about this. Why? Why are you not normal in this? What kind of sociopath tries to scratch their own itch instead of blaming others?
Yeah, so I want to share this infographic. Okay, so this is not Austrian per se, although I don't really see why it wouldn't be Austrian, but it's Coase. And so it's Coasean. And it's kind of getting into the theory of the firm. And in when we look at software development in general, usually it's bottom right, integration, internal organization. When it's the Obamacare website, it's a government monopoly, and we saw how that ended. But usually it's a corporation, right, that's doing that. Now,
Can you just describe the chart before?
So basically it's about the trade-off between figuring out the difference between telling someone to do something and incentivizing them to do it would kind of be how I'd simplify it. And that there are transaction costs involved with both. And information costs are kind of a part of the transaction costs. But it's like, how do I get people to work on what I want them to work on? And so when you're an entrepreneur, you're trying to combine capital on one side, right, with raw material and employees on the other side. And you're trying to coordinate all of these resources. And so it's very hard to do this on the spot market if you were to be like, all right, I'm going to pay people, I'm going to pay my airline pilots by the hour. Okay.
I should just say that the chart will be on the podcast notes. So if you're listening, just go to saving.com/podcast and you'll see the chart.
Yeah. And so if you were to have like Uber for airline pilots, that's too expensive. But you can have Uber for taxi cab drivers. And the reason that that is affordable is because you can, they have completely different structures of production, right? With the airline example, you have to coordinate with lots of passengers. With the taxi cab, you only have to coordinate with one passenger. Okay, now Uber obviously figured out ways to do, having, what's that called? Sharing with other people and whatnot. But anyway, the idea being that depending on what's going on in the market, and what the fundamentals are in the marketplace between the demand and the supply, the way that you're going to have firms coordinate with each other is also going to differ. And so ideally, you can just go in the spot market And by the spot market, what that means is that you have firms putting up a price, right? And so, for example, when you go to Amazon.com, that's the spot market in a way, where it says, all right, if you want this stupid thing from China, it's cost $20. Okay, go spend it. Now, if you want a custom made version of that, now you've got to essentially enter into some kind of joint venture with some Chinese manufacturer to have your custom manufactured product, right? And so the cost of doing that is much greater for the consumer, and thus the consumer is not going to do it. They're going to depend on the spot market. Okay, so you have this in software development as well. And in software development, usually it's tightly coordinated in the sense that you need to hire a front-end engineer, you need to hire a back-end engineer, you need to hire a product manager, and then you need to hire a manager for those three guys, and then you need to hire someone to manage the manager, right? And so there's all this overhead in software development. And open source kind of emerged, or you could argue open source preceded this, but in the open source world, it's just software developers doing whatever they want, scratching their own itch. And so there's no need for coordination because usually you have one guy, he may or may not be autistic. He wants to build this whole piece of software, right, to meet his need as a consumer. So that's a really high cost for anyone who doesn't want to write software for 80 hours a day. And then, you know, we had people like Steve Ballmer, who was the former CEO of Microsoft, who was saying, oh, you know, open source software is communism, right? Because you're telling people to share their software. Whereas you have enlightened individuals like Stefan Kinsella who say, hey, intellectual property is communism or it's a state construction. It's BS. And it's, you know, software code is just information. And so it makes sense that it would be freely shareable. Now, the problem is, how do we make it so that that information is actually solving problems for users, right? Because if you go on github.com, where a lot of the open source software is, 90% of it is going to be useless, right? It's just useless code. Okay, so how do we coordinate between people who have money, who want open source code, for whatever reason, right? It might be because they're feeling charitable and they kind of want a positive externality or whatever, or they have a specific problem that they need fixed. And that problem happens to be in some open source code that they are using, that they are depending on. And so it doesn't even have to be Bitcoin, right? And so the solution I built is obviously, it's focused on Bitcoin right now in its first iteration. But long term, what I see this software is allowing us to do is that consumers of software don't have to go through corporations in order to get the software they want. They can actually go directly to the open source authors, the software developers themselves, and immediately, first of all, signal what they want to have built. Now, in the spot market, we usually call this a limit order, right? And so in an order book, you're going to have bids and asks, where you are signaling to the other parties in the market that you are willing to sell at this price, this amount of whatever, or that you're willing to buy at this price, this amount of whatever. And that's the spot market, right? And what that allows people to do is to flock to the marketplace, look at the order book, and then make entrepreneurial decisions, right? Because now they have kind of a public price system. They don't have to enter into private negotiations with people, sign NDAs, and then, you know, okay, here's how much I'm willing to pay, right? They open the kimono and say, okay, here's what we're willing to pay for, right? All of this adds friction to the process, where now we have to have a joint venture or some kind of franchising agreement to figure out the pricing system between the supplier and the consumer, right? It's all... And then you got to have lawyers involved and contracts, all this overhead. And then it gets worse with fiat, right? With reversible payments. Okay, so so we have this limit order, this spot market. And Saifedean, if we could go to bitcoinax.com. And you'll see that to me, what a limit order is, it's a pledge, right? You're pledging to spend money on something. And on BitcoinX.com, the first thing you can do as a user is that you can pledge Bitcoin specifically targeted to a pull request. So, okay, what's a pull request? You can kind of think of it as a change request, right? You're asking someone to change the software for you. And so you see that big orange button, pledge Bitcoin. Above, you see how much Bitcoin have already been pledged, right? And so you're able to see, okay, if people work on this part of the code, then maybe, now here's why a pledge is different than an actual limit order. In an actual order book, when you have a limit order, and you have someone come in and buy it, they're able to immediately fill it. In a pledge, that's kind of disconnected. There's not any obligation to sell, right? There's not any obligation to send the Bitcoin if the change gets made. There is only an indication that you might, right? And so why is that the case? Okay, so here's why that's the case. In a limit order book, for example, for Bitcoin, it's very clear about what you're buying, right? You're buying some number of Satoshis. In an order book for code, there's going to be subjective appraisal of whether the goods and services have been delivered or not, of whether the code actually satisfies what you wanted when you put the pledge. Because otherwise, the developers could scam you, right? And they could say, all right, you promised to pay X amount if I wrote this code and you didn't pay it. And then your response is, yeah, but the code you wrote doesn't work. Okay, so, all right, how are we going to adjudicate this dispute? In a firm, you know, your boss would be like, hey, can you step into my office? We need to talk, right? We need to talk about your future at the company because the code you wrote sucks. And in open source, it's like you get to just complain about it on Twitter. With Bitcoin X, you can just not pay the money. You can be like, well, look, I'm just going to walk away. I don't care. And so, all right, what if the pledger starts abusing this, right? Of they create a pledge, you actually wrote the code, it works, and then they renege on the pledge. Well, then you know what you can do? You can start ignoring pledges. Okay. And you can complain to Pierre that you basically got scammed, right? And then when that starts happening, I don't even know that it's going to happen, honestly. But if it starts happening, there's mitigations I can put in place, right? I could have a reputational system. Okay, you have to have paid, you have to have made whole on pledges in the past, right? Maybe I apply a ratio between how much you have paid and how much you have pledged. And kind of that's how BitTorrent works with seeding, right? It puts in place a ratio between how much have you uploaded versus how much have you downloaded. So there's other mechanisms I could build. And, you know, in the crypto industry, there are people who love obsessing over mechanisms like this. To me, it's like, we don't have to build the mechanism until people actually start abusing the system. Because if they don't actually abuse the system, then there's no reason for me to build these complex mitigations and to go and figure out, all right, how do we prevent spam and whatnot if it's not actually a problem? Okay, anyway, I'm kind of getting into some finer details here. But the idea is that you can say, hey, I want to send you Bitcoin. And you know what I've seen? I've seen the opposite happen, where people send the Bitcoin to the software engineer before the code gets added, before it gets merged, because they're already happy with the progress that has already been made in the past before the pledge was even made. Right. And isn't that beautiful that humans act in their self-interest, right? Because it is in the self-interest of the pledger to say, hey, look, here's how I'm going to prove to you that I'm going to pay you in the future. Let me just pay you right now. Right? For work you've done in the past, even though I never gave any indication that I was going to pay you, but I'm going to pay you for past work as a signal that I'm also going to pay you for future work. And then here's the amazing part with Bitcoin, BitcoinX.com doesn't hold any of the money at any point. The money goes straight to the developer because the developer actually goes into their settings. And you can only do this if you log in. I don't know if Saifedean has a GitHub account. Let's call him out on this. Let's shame him.
I do, actually.
If you hit log in at the top right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, sorry. It's hidden behind the...
I do, but I'm not sure I'm from this browser. I can.
Let's see.
Device code.
The security is strong in this one.
Yeah.
It's good. I like it. We would not want the Saifedean GitHub account to get hacked. But what if he put in a pull request to change Bitcoin's monetary policy? All of his lemmings would jump right off the cliff with him.
I want to stop the share at least. So
yeah.
This feels a little too intrusive.
Oh yeah, like in
device like, verification cores. Yeah.
Watching you change your underwear, huh?
So authorize Piero Shard's app. Should I do that? You think? All right. Well,
I'm only asking for the email address. That's the only thing you're authorizing me to get is your email address. So that's the other thing I want to make clear. I'm not trying to hack anyone's GitHub account with this. So now Safe could go up to user settings in the top right.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hit the little crayon on the left there, mm-hmm. the edit button, and you could add your BTC Pay server.
Uh-huh.
And so then you actually receive the Bitcoin on your BTC Pay server, whether it's on-chain or Lightning, and you generate the invoice, you generate the address. I don't do any of that, right? All I'm doing is just transferring information. I don't touch the money. And that's really, to me, one of the amazing parts is, you know, obviously on Saifedean's webinar, we only talk about Bitcoin scarcity, but Bitcoin's utility in commerce, right, in payments, is also something to talk about, right? And this is really where I think that it's beautiful that I can enable someone to send cash over the internet to someone else, and I don't have to get involved, right? If they don't want to send the cash, they don't have to send the cash. If they don't want to receive the cash, they don't have to receive the cash. It's a free market, right?
It's a voluntary system. And I think it's absolutely amazing how many layers of sophisticated economic organization can be built on a purely voluntary system. And I think it's something that the economics textbook does a great job of trying to sabotage people's conception of this idea, of trying to make it look like everybody is a Keynesian sociopath and everybody's out to get everybody else, and that the only way that we can fix the life of, you know, sort of, the only way that we can have people interact with each other is if we, you know, have a benevolent benevolent dictator managing all the markets, or, you know, dictator, or it can be a Democrat. It doesn't really ultimately matter. But somebody has to be in power in part as part of every transaction in order to make sure that that transaction runs smoothly.
Yeah. And like Bitcoin X doesn't have to have terms of service. You know, I don't have to have a contract or go harangue people about anything. And I really think that Bitcoin, and really, you know, we could talk about software more generally, but Bitcoin specifically changes the economics of the firm. And we don't even know this yet because we're not post-hyper-Bitcoinization. We're only starting to get glimpses of it. For businesses that do interact with Bitcoin, they start realizing, oh, you know what? This could actually help in other ways that I had not foreseen. And so I think that we're just going to see more and more innovation come out of this, where it's not really like, I guess it's not Austrian economics per se. It's more about entrepreneurialism, right? And understanding what are the opportunities that technology unlocks for you. And for Bitcoin, it's both, hey, holding it as cash, like Michael Saylor on his balance sheet. Now, I also want to talk with Michael Saylor about, you know, maybe MicroStrategy might want to you know, build some Bitcoin related products, right? And we're starting to see businesses build all sorts of different Bitcoin related products, from hardware wallets to t-shirts, to hats, to economics education.
Yeah, absolutely. The possibilities are endless. The incredible thing about Bitcoin really is, imagine just how much freedom it introduces into all of these economic transactions that people can have once the money is free from intervention. And one thing that you've said repeatedly, and I agree with you on this, is that, you know, Bitcoin censorship resistance, the most important use case for it, the most important transaction that gets censored in the 20th century is transactions between you and your future self. Your ability to save is the biggest and most important enemy to your government and its money. And it's, you know, your government is a war on saving. Government lives off, the strength of the government is how much it can suck resources out of the savings of its people. And so the more savings they have, the more the government can devalue the savings and finance itself. And that's how monetary systems in the 20th century have functioned. And you've played an incredible role in just helping me clarify the distinction between saving and investment from an accounting perspective, because in economics, in the economic textbook, there's really, in the mainstream economics textbook that are taught at universities today, these terms are conflated beyond any sense. There's no meaning to the term saving or investment that makes any sense, and they're used interchangeably at times. And the condition of equilibrium in the Keynesian model is that saving has to be equal to investment, as if they're the same thing. But of course, as an accountant, you know that saving and investment are very distinct things. How are they different?
Yeah, so the reason that the Keynesians think that they should be equal is that for them, saving is only a flow. And so you take someone's income, you see, okay, what do they spend on consumption, right? And then what do they save to invest? And then they say that very quickly, right? Safe to invest. You know, there's no just save, right? Because to them, if you just save, if you just hold the money, that causes the economy to collapse.
You're a sociopath.
Yeah. What an insane person. They literally like call you a hoarder, you know, that you're mentally ill for holding cash. Okay. So let's step back and say, all right, are people actually mentally ill, right? It's a, let's say maybe there's the science, right? Maybe people are mentally ill. Or is there an alternative explanation? And the Austrians have an alternative explanation. So let's hear it out. People are holding cash because there is uncertainty they are feeling about future cash flows. So they don't know when they're going to get cash inflows, and they don't necessarily even know when they're going to have cash outflows, right? What if their car breaks down and they need to get it fixed? Okay, that's an uncertain future cash flow. What if they get a raise? That's also an uncertain future cash flow. You know, and so there's no actuarial probabilities that you can attach to these things, right? So they're not risks that are quantifiable and that you could go hedge or buy insurance on. They are fundamental uncertainties about the future. And they are fundamental uncertainties that will never go away. There's no government program that will make it such that humans no longer have to deal with uncertainty, right? In fact, government programs increase uncertainty, right? So for example, with coronavirus, people were not holding enough cash because the government was using inflation to punish people for holding cash. And now we have this uncertain future cash flow at a macro level, right? That is occurring to the entire economic system. And so now we have a systemic cash shortage. All right, well, what's the solution? Okay, who can print cash? All right, the Federal Reserve, the federal government. You know, they can print cash. All right. They'll do the, they'll start lending it out. Oh, who gets a loan? Who doesn't? Guess what? That is political uncertainty, right? Now you don't know if you're going to get a cash flow for the government from the government or not. You don't know how much you're going to get. Are you going to get $1,200 from the government, or are you going to get $60,000 from the government? You don't know. It's going to just depend on the mood of Mnuchin. Right? which side of the bed is going to wake up on the in this morning of negotiation. Okay, so politics, government, that only adds to uncertainty. It does not decrease uncertainty. Where were we going with this?
Well, the way that you can never eliminate uncertainty, but you can reduce it. And the way you reduce it is that you carry cash, because going into the future, if you come into the future with cash in your pocket, then you know whatever kind of uncertainty is thrown at you, you have some cash that you can throw at it. So you break a leg, you can afford to go to the hospital. You need a place to stay, you can afford to buy or rent a place to stay because you have some cash. That's really ultimately what cash does. And it's an enormously important economic institution.
Now, let's tie it to investment, right?
Yes.
Because then the question is, all right, why don't people immediately invest their cash, right? Because even let's say, okay, well, you think that you're going to have an uncertain future cash flow in 6 months. Why don't you lend out that money with a 6 month duration, and then you'll have the money in 6 months? Well, because you don't know what the timing of future cash flows is going to be. That's the uncertainty. So you don't know if in 6 months you're going to want to start a business, right? Or your business is going to suffer. So there's the timing problem. And on top of that, when you lend out cash, you're introducing additional risk and uncertainty, because you don't know that the cash is going to come back to you in 6 months.
Yes.
Right? It can be.
And also you're missing out on the liquidity throughout the 6 months.
Yeah. The optionality of having that cash on your balance sheet is worth something. And so, the Keynesians will say, well, oh, you could earn 6% yield. You know what? That's the same argument that the yield farming scammers give you, right?
Absolutely.
Come earn this risk-free yield. Is it actually risk-free? Of course not. Of course not. And so that's where the Austrians argue that holding cash is not a mental illness. In fact, it is beneficial to the person holding cash, and we should not, as a matter of public policy, try to beat that person with a stick until they spend the cash or until they invest it. And that we don't want savings to be equal to investment. We want savings to be greater than investment, right? We want investment to be less than savings, so that ultimately we have an economic system that is more robust and sustainable and can survive uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think one point that they miss is that saving is the father of investing. And chronologically, logically, praxeologically, you cannot invest without first saving. You know, you can't dedicate new grains, you can't put them into the ground in order to grow new corns without first saving the corn grains, without first not eating them. You have to first defer the consumption and delay the consumption. You have to save before you are able to invest. And in fact, as time preference drops, we start saving more. And as we start saving more, as we are able to, as we meet our cash demands, or put it more accurately, as the marginal utility of extra cash balance declines, then we can afford to start putting some money into investment. But we can't invest without first saving. We have to always first go through the stage of saving. So in fact, if you encourage more saving, people would have more saving, then they would invest more. But when people are unable to invest and unable to save, then it gets much harder for many people to invest at all, because they can never accumulate the savings, because the savings are constantly losing their value as a melting ice cube, as last week's guest Michael Saylor put it.
So the other part I would add on the investing part is, not only can they invest more, but it's of higher quality, because it's like in poker. If the blinds are increasing and they're trying to make the game faster, you're going to play worse hands. But if the blinds are, and with deflation, you have negative blinds, right? Where you are being rewarded with an increase in your purchasing power over time. Well, now, instead of having to find the first, subprime mortgage you can lend to, you can wait until you find the best piece of real estate that comes on the market, and then you buy it and you develop it, right? And so the quality of capital accumulation also dramatically increases. And so then we get out of this boom-bust cycle as well. So now the other part that I think the Keynesian, the equation of savings equals investment misses, is that savings doesn't necessarily go to investment. It might be going to future consumption without going through investment. And so you could have someone who says, hey, look, I don't want to buy a chair today. I want to wait for a higher quality chair at a lower price in the future. And instead of telling them, no, that is incorrect, you must buy this chair today, right? Which, why would we have that? Why would have that view as a matter of policy, right? That people buy chairs today. Maybe they're perfectly happy with their primitive stool, or maybe they built their own chair, right?
They'll make do.
Yeah, but they're waiting for, you know, an expertly crafted chair from the Amish, right? And they want to buy that, but they want to buy it in the future. So I think that it's okay for them to hold cash and to just sit on money until they buy the chair next year, right? And that's fine. I don't understand why the IMF hates that.
it's
there
incredible.
We go. That's their point of view, right?
Yeah, that's what they think. They think, you know, you need to be spending in order for the economy to function. And I think there's you know, even ignoring all of the problems that we've mentioned about the confusions around investment, even if we were to take it at face value, I think the goldfish type attention span of the Keynesian prevents them from understanding the reality that if saving exists and you're deciding not to buy the chair today, well, guess what? Somebody last year decided not to buy that chair and waited until this year. So there must be somebody who's dis-saving somewhere, because, you know, you don't save that money and then it just goes into the bottom of the ocean. You save it and then you send it in the future. And time is not just the current minute in which we as Keynesians are enjoying our most base desires. Time is a very long process. And so there are people who saved in the past who are going to be spending today, and there are people saving today who are going to be spending in the future. And that's just normal. It makes sense for them as individuals. And this idea of pathologizing it, that you need to make your decision to buy your own chair based on what is best for society, and that the sooner that you buy it, the better off society is just another horrible implication of the mathematics.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to take this time. Now that Safe isn't here, I get to shill French economist Jean-Baptiste Say. He came up with this saying, markets clear. And so even when you have, for example, if I choose to not buy the chair, that means that the person selling the chair, they have to mark down the price of their chair, right? Because they have to attract demand. And in that process of deflation, right? That's how the market works. I'm giving someone else more purchasing power. So the less I spend on consumer goods, the more other people's money is worth, and thus they can go buy the chair. And they do it at a lower price point. So when you're holding money, really what you're doing is you're increasing the purchasing power of everyone else's money, and you're allowing the market to clear at a lower price. And that ultimately is going to cause the structure of production to change upstream. But it's not really, it's not like the chair is never going to get bought. You know, unless nobody in the world wants to buy a chair, even at the lowest price imaginable, right? In which case, that's fine too, right? If the cost of producing chairs is greater than the price people are willing to pay for chairs, then there will be no chairs. And the reality is that there's a wide variety of goods for which that is true, right? The cost of building a space shuttle is greater than the price that any of one on this call, I'm assuming Elon Musk is not on this call, is willing to pay or even able to pay. And thus, yes, we should want the price of rockets to come down. We need deflation. Yeah.
And also, you know, there's the possibility that your chair sucks and, you know, people shouldn't want to buy it. There's no market out there for mud pies because it costs time and money to make a mud pie and nobody wants to pay for a mud pie. And that's an important market signal. And it's amazing how Keynesians want to present that as if it's a failing on the part of the people who refuse to buy the crappy chair. When, you know, the chair maker should be asking themselves, how do I make this chair better? And I think this was related to the degradation in the quality of goods that you see under fiat, which I think many people suspect, but we can't really put our finger on it, which is that when people just need to sell and you need to constantly sell and people have money that's burning a hole in their pocket, then, you know, you're willing to buy a rickety table because it's okay, it's better than holding on to money. Whereas when money is hard, you're only going to part with your money when the table is likely to survive and likely to serve you for a long time. So you'll be more likely to buy high quality stuff. It could well be the case that fiat money gives us shitty fiat goods.
I was having a conversation with someone too about there's TV shows like Hoarders, or Marie Kondo is very popular, where she's helping people clean out their house. And you watch this, and my going theory now is that when government and when Keynesians say you're not allowed to hoard money, it's not like people just go and they don't hoard anything. They end up hoarding consumer goods. And
that's
so
very true.
You have entire, you know, 4,000 square foot homes filled to this goddamn ceiling with hoarded consumer goods, right? Yeah. And it's not, I really, like, did that happen in 1800, right? Or is this a relatively new phenomenon where people are shifting their ability to store value because, you know, that's, and they also, okay.
No, it's very true. I think also if you think in particular about durable consumer goods, like in Latin America, everybody needs to buy an apartment because that's your saving account. You know, you don't put any money in your saving account. You work your way up to an apartment. So real estate in all those places is massively overbid because people need durable consumer goods because that's the closest thing that you can get to a saving instrument.
Now, the other interesting thing is, like, you know, baseball cards, you know, those kinds of stores of value where you're also taking, like, I also think that those essentially have gotten monetized due to fiat inflation.
I agree.
Where people hoard all these things inside their house. And one of the rationalizations they use is, well, I could sell this on eBay, right? And so there's a market price for this, and I'm going to be able to use this as a store of value. Now, the other thing that I would note from, and I could go and talk about this all day long, because I don't have anything after this. So I could just, I could literally, and I could filibuster your program for, we could do a 24-hour live stream telethon, you know, like for fundraisers. I feel like we should do that for Austrian Economics and Bitcoin. But anyway, you know, I've got a 2.5-year-old son, and, we were at my parents' house, and my parents, they had three sons, one of them being myself. And so in this inflationary environment and in an environment where they loved their sons very much, they bought us a lot of toys, okay? A lot of Legos, a lot of Playmobil. And they actually are pretty high quality, you know, replicas of knights in shining armor, et cetera. And so we're pulling them out again because my parents hoarded them as a store of value. And now it's intergenerational. And my son, their grandson, is now inheriting these toys. At the same time, my son is also receiving new toys, right? So, like, if you look at the Playmobil that are coming out in 2020 and you put them side by side with the Playmobil from 1990, markedly different quality. It's astounding. Mm-hmm. In a bad way. They have gotten worse, but they are at the same dollar price. They're at the same dollar price, and they're remarkably worse. And I completely understand what happened, right? They were targeting the dollar price, and they were adjusting their cost of production to match that dollar price because they don't want to cause the. And then you know what, Safe? The crazy part: you go on Amazon or on eBay, and you want to buy a 1990 Playmobil. First of all, it hasn't been manufactured since then, right? And it costs multiples, 10x the dollar price of what it was back then. Because, you know, you might say, oh, there's people buying it for sentimental value because that's what, you know, they want the new version. I think that's the market clearing price, right? And that's the inflation. CPI should look at how much does it cost to buy, you know, this thing. But they can't do it, right? They can't do it because ultimately they're controlled by political charlotans. But anyway, going on and on about this.
Yeah, and I think I think that there's definitely a case to be made that, you know, had we had a decent money, we would have had we would have had price deflation. We would have had a drop in prices continuously. You know, we'd have probably witnessed Lego staying in good quality and its price dropping over time. And I think the price of everything would be dropping most likely.
Yeah, and the quality of toys will be increasing. And I really, that's where I think that it's important for the kids, Bitcoin, right? And yeah.
Yes, Bitcoin is for the future generations. Well, Pierre, thank you so much. This has been heroic on your part. The rants were epic and the numbers were run. And
hopefully not in too much detail.
No, that was good. That was excellent. I mean, this is why we bring you here. Thank you very much. And you'll be delighted to know next week our guest is going to be none other than Michael Goldstein, Bitstein.
Amazing.
Yes. And we are going to be talking about the fact that it has been exactly 1 year. Actually, today is, 5 years. Today is the 5-year anniversary of both Michael and I starting the carnivore diet. Coincidentally, we both started it on the same day or roughly around the same day. And independently, we had both just come across the same internet rabbit holes and tried it out on the 1st of October, 2015. So it's been 5 years. And next week, we're going to be chatting with him about meat, steak, and fiat foods, and the economics of fiat food, and how Bitcoin fixes this, and his plans for bringing the bison back to Rome in the US. So, of course, you're welcome to join, Pierre. Your expertise on the matter would be highly appreciated as well.
You know that I can filibuster, and I can rant for a long time. And I want to give Bitstein the opportunity. And also tell Bitstein that he needs to do the Bitcoin bounties for steaks, right? So that it's not just software, right? It's also steaks.
Absolutely. That's a terrific idea. Or just with bison. Like you get an actual bison delivered to your home. I think that's...
On a drone. It just gets dropped onto your home.
This is the future. Uber for bison. Join us next week to discuss the details of this. All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Bye.